became of Helen Trent. My name is Richard Lamparsky, and I'm with a lady today with a very surprised look on her face. How did you like that music?
That was great fun hearing it.
That was the authentic love theme, wasn't it?
It was the authentic love theme,
all right.
Now,
who was that humming?
Well, I think it was Stan Davis who hummed for us for so many years.
All those years, I thought it was Gil Whitney.
No, Gil was busy working on his lines. He didn't have time to hum.
Well, I didn't tell the audience what your real name is, and it's Julie Stevens.
That's right.
And you've come in to New York from out of town today where you live, and you're a suburbanite now.
No, not suburb, please. Country.
Country.
Yes. As a matter of fact, unfortunately, it's rapidly becoming a suburb, and we're going to be moving before too long, probably, to get away from it. But when we moved out to Armonk, it was really country. Really beautiful. But highways are now going through, and, you know, the usual ruination.
I must say, I can see why you didn't play the role on television, because you don't look 35 yet.
Aren't you a darling?
No, you're
Thank
really
you.
Don't. You're terribly pretty. And I was rather surprised. I thought, well, you know, Helen Trent, she should be, you know, middle-aged-ish.
Oh, you're darling.
No, you're a very attractive lady.
Well, that's very sweet of you. Well, let me tell you how I happened to almost not get the job, as a matter of fact, speaking of that very thing. The day that Helen Trent was auditioning, or the day they were auditioning the show, bringing it here from Chicago. You know, all of the soap operas really originated out there. That was the big
place. Yes, nearly all of them
place.
Did, and many of them stayed there.
Well, no, there was quite an exodus. And as a matter of fact, we used to look with great scorn on the Chicago actors as they came in. And the great scorn was because they were here taking our jobs. But anyway, we all became great friends and integrated very nicely. But there, for a while, I mean, really, it was a very definite thing. There were two casts, New York actors and Chicago actors. And
I mean,
the New York actors,
West Coast and New York.
That's right, that's right. And the New York actors were, you see, for the most part, people from theater. And we were doing radio until the great play came along. And most of us, fortunately, would get into plays. Well, on radio shows, they would write us off and let us do plays. And as for my part, I was only in one hit, so I was very happy to go back to my radio, believe me. But anyway, I had gotten the part of Kitty Foyle directly from a Broadway play I was doing called Brooklyn, USA, which happened to have a great many radio people in it. And they got a lot of radio producers and directors and casting people to come to it to see them. And so I was called to do Kitty Foyle, and or for an audition, directly from this play. And I did the part for 2 years. Well, anyway, I've been digressing. The day that Kitty Foyle went off the air was a very sad one. Bud Collier had played my leading man on that, and we were very fond of each other, and the whole cast was. Having been together for 2 years, it was like being in a hit play, you know. And Nell Allen was the announcer, and oh, it was just a lovely, lovely thing. A man named Reichel Kent was the director, and he was a fine director, and he was from the theater. And he was the one who first put the pauses into radio. People were afraid to pause because of the very early days when you'd turn your, I want to say channel, you turn your dial.
Yeah.
Oh, because you figured something was wrong with the station. The station had gone off the air if there was any silence. So you had to just talk all the time. No dead air, as they called it. Well, Reichel believed in pauses, as I say, from the theater. He was an old stock actor. And so we got to pause in Kitty Foyle, which, of course, was great for me because my training was mostly theater. And we also got to do our own sound effects. And we would walk. He'd have microphones all around the studio. So it was just like being on stage. So we'd all adored this, and we'd all been so happy. So the day Kitty Foyle was to go off the air, oh, I was in tears, of course, and it was pouring rain, and oh, it was just gassy. I thought, oh, I don't want to go to that audition. But anyway, I'd better go. So I walked across the street, up in the elevator, and oh, soaking wet, just from the little walk across the street, and of course still weeping. And an actress quote, friend, unquote, looked at me and she said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I was called to audition. And she said, but you're much too young for the part. Because I didn't know anything about Helen Trent at that time. And, you know, I very nearly, in fact, I had already turned to walk to the elevator. But I thought, now, look.
Yes, in radio.
You sure she isn't trying to skunk you? You go in there. I walked in and got the job. But I really was within an inch of just because I was so miserable anyway. You know, that I just wanted to go home and weep. And isn't that
well,
something?
Well, that's an interesting story, yeah.
I think it is because I just...
almost, you know, to give up sometimes.
Exactly. When... Just exactly. So that was the best job in the world, of course. And Kitty Foyle went off the air on Friday, and on Monday I became Helen Trent.
I think it's very close to a story that Virginia Payne told me, Ma Perkins, because she, I think, was 22 when she
That's
got
right.
that role.
That's right, she was very young.
And she told me she auditioned with something like 20-some girls,
mm-hmm.
or ladies, I guess, at that mm-hmm. time. And she said, I didn't think I had a prayer
no.
at getting this,
no.
because the original character of Ma Perkins was from Tugboat Annie, which I didn't remember.
Oh, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the character changed entirely within the first few years. They kept softening her
until
we finally got the Ma Perkins we remember.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a coarse old lady. Well, she said she did her audition and walked outside the studio, and there was Molly, Fibber McGee and Molly.
Yes.
It was a big hit in Chicago at that time, doing, I think she said the program was called The Smackouts. Was an early radio show, and she said to her, you know, you've got a very good character there. She said, oh, I don't think I'll get it. And she said, well, don't let it bother you, because you should get it. That's the important thing. You were the best.
Isn't
she said, I was about to go home,
marvelous.
And of course she got it.
Do you know, I didn't, all these years I've known Jenny, I didn't know that story. But then, of course, you see, she came with the show from Chicago.
Yes.
And all these... Well, all these shows have been going on for a long time, of course, out there.
Well, now tell us, where is Gil Whitney?
As far as I know, he's in California. Unfortunately, I don't know where. I've been trying to find out. He was living in Santa Monica. And the last I heard, and he'd be marvelous at this, was that he was managing a supermarket. But he had all the charm, you know, and all the manner and everything. He, I don't know, when he first went out there, he started to go on with acting, but he got pretty discouraged. And at that time, of course, so many people were going out there. And he just, I don't know, he sort of felt that he'd like to try something else. So he, a new Japanese department store was opening. And so he became involved in that. And as I say, he has the wonderful manner and everything. Just be great. Now, I heard that he was managing this supermarket somewhere in Southern California. Whether this is true or not, I don't know.
Be interesting to check.
Well, I don't know how to get hold of him. I will. Why don't
I
you
will.
Try
I'm
through
obsessed
after?
With things like that. I will, and I'll let you know.
Oh, please do, because I'd love to know.
Now, what about Agatha?
Well, Agatha died.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes. Oh, she was a wonderful woman, Bess McCammon. And she came from Chicago, and at first we resented her very much because a lady who was a friend of ours, a New York actress, was playing the part. And when Bess came on from Chicago, Bess replaced her. And we didn't like that at all, of course. But we came to love her very, very much. Darling elderly Ag.
Well, I'm glad you said that because... I was going to say, you know, I always thought that Agatha undermined your romances.
Oh, yes. Well, of course.
Really?
Everybody undermined my romances.
Well, I thought she was awfully somber and seemed quite negative. You would be thrilled to death with some new beau, and she would just say, or something. I think, why doesn't she mind her own business?
We wouldn't have had a good story then.
I guess not. Agatha was an old maid, wasn't she?
Oh, yes.
Oh, what am I
yes,
saying?
My companion.
Saying a thing like an old maid to Helen Trent. Have you ever thought...
Well, now, Helen Trent was married.
She was a widow.
She...
Right?
Well, that they were never... You see, they always kept that, which was so smart. These people who wrote, and particularly the people who planned these shows, Mr. and Mrs. Hummert, were so smart because they always kept things kind of not sure, then they could always use things. In fact, even when we ended the show, the last day of the show, it wasn't really ended. In other words, if Helen Trent wanted to go back on the air, they could take right. No, I wasn't married again. Not the last day. It looked as though I was going to be.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought you were married.
No, no. Mm-mm.
Because you were nearly married several times.
Oh, heavens, yes, all the time.
But it was Gil Whitney but, you were nearly going to marry.
Well, the thing is, you see, that she was Mrs. Trent, and Mr. Trent, now, I get this, as I say, secondhand, because I had not, I'm sorry to say, I'd never even heard of the show. I was too busy trying to get in the theater. But as I remember, Mr. Trent had sort of disappeared in an accident at sea or something, but no one really knew whether or not he was really gone.
But he never reappeared in the
story. No, but you see, they kept it so they could bring him in if they needed him, which I think was terrible
to have around them. How sneaky of those Hummers. Frank and Ann Hummer.
Yes, oh, and what marvelous people. What marvelous people, what wonderful people to work for. It was so cute the day that I went in to sign my contract. Their business manager said, you won't make as much as though you were, say, exclusive on another show. But, he said, in the long run, if you like to work, I think you'll find that your paycheck will more than equal those of your friends who have exclusive contracts. Because the wonderful thing was that you just worked on all their shows. I would run right over from Trent and play a villainess on Stella Dallas. And it was just great. So you just go practically roller skate from one show to another because they had so many of them.
Yes, all the radio people I've talked to moonlighted on these various
programs. Oh, sure.
Arthur Hughes said he worked nearly
all of them. Oh, everything.
Matt Elsner said she was... you said she ran a boarding house in Georgia when you were making a picture down there.
That's right, sure.
Now,
sure.
Helen was a dress designer.
Dress designer, headgown designer.
Studio.
Yeah, like an Edith Head person.
I always thought of you as Edith Head coming
through. I thought
you'd be wearing those famous dark glasses that Edith Head always wears.
No.
And Gil Whitney, and we didn't say his name was David Gothard.
David Gothard.
Was a lawyer.
Yes,
right? And he had a ranch in the valley, I remember.
That's right.
San Fernando Valley.
He had this valet who was his equivalent of Agatha, Bugsy O'Toole.
Oh, yes. Rather a diamond in the rough.
He was a darling person. Character. Yes. And he's the one who, when Gil Whitney and Cynthia Swanson, and that's Mary Jane Higbee, she was When a Girl Marries. She'd come from When a Girl Marries, being the star of that, the leading woman, and come over and be the villainess on my show.
I didn't realize she was Cynthia Swanson.
Yes, that was Mary Jane, and she was marvelous.
She's
she was
doing
so
a book
good.
On radio.
I know she is. I know we had lunch and talked about
it. She's a neighbor of our gal Sunday, Vivian Stolen.
Yes, I know.
She was also on this program. I'm getting to all of you sooner or later.
Wonderful. Well, Bugsy, Cynthia Swanson and Gil were married, much to the horrification, is there such a word, of our listeners. And we got so many letters complaining about this thing. So the night they were going off on their honeymoon, Bugsy put tacks on the driveway, and so they had one puncture after another and couldn't go. And Gil then had his moment of truth and decided, oh, horrors, he wasn't really in love with Cynthia. She had just talked him into this. It was really Helen he loved, so
yes,
back he came to me.
He was sort of trapped into that marriage.
Yes.
Because she was the heavy.
Oh, yes, the heaviest of heavies.
Yes. Now, I'm testing my memory on this, because I didn't look it up. As I remember, Cynthia Swanson was something like a nurse or a secretary who married beau of yours on his deathbed.
That's right. She was a teacher. Physics, I believe. And Gil met her when they were both... He was lecturing, or for some reason he was in, I think, San Diego, doing something or other at this school, and she was there. And, Don McLaughlin was Swanson, Dwight Swanson.
And was Don McLaughlin not also Dr. Brent wanted in surgery?
Oh, yes.
Why,
sure. And he has been on... As the World Turns, I think it is, on television.
He's on one of them, I know.
I think it's As the World Turns. Well, anyway, darling Don, we always had such fun people, which was one of the nicer parts of radio. And there wasn't so much backbiting as there was in the theater or in pictures. It was really a very pleasant sort of thing. And Don was Dwight Swanson, and he was a beau of mine, and of course fabulously rich. All my beaux always were, except Gil was, well, I don't know, he never seemed to work, but he was well off, but he wasn't as fabulously rich as all the rest of them. But anyway, Don is a marvelous cartoonist. And he would make cartoons of all of us, you see, and of the various episodes. And he always had Cynthia in these big tennis shoes, just sneaking around, because she was always listening at doors, you see, gum-shoeing around to try to get something on me.
Am I right, though, she married...
yes, his plane crashed into the side of a mountain. And while he was practically half-conscious, she married him. So she came into all his fortune, you see. So then she really lorded it over everybody.
I remember another beau you had. I can't think of his name, but as I remember, he was one of the fellows who played on I Love a Mystery. Just from his voice now, I seem to remember it. Now, I'll tell you a little bit more about
him.
You remember. It was at the end of the war, and you were out on a date with him one night, and you couldn't get a cab. And he said, oh, well, we'll buy a car. And you said, well, that's crazy. He was very rich, by the way.
Oh, of course.
You said, you can't buy a car. You can't buy cars, even with money. And there are no cars being made right now. It was about 1946. So he went in and bought a Jeep, a brand new Jeep. Agatha thought that was just ridiculous.
I don't even remember that.
That anyone would buy a Jeep just to drive Helen Trent home.
Oh, lovely. I don't remember that.
Well, I do.
At all. Isn't that
I was
funny?
A very faithful listener.
Well, you certainly were, I must say.
That program.
You must have been a baby.
Oh, thank you. Bless you. The program began in 1933. What year did it go off?
Did it? I didn't even know that part. It started in New York, June 1944. And it's been off, what, 3 or 4 years, I think? I can't
tell
you
the exact date. Yes, it was one of the last to go off.
Yes, uh-huh. It was, as a matter of fact, it was Nip and Tuck. They were comparing ratings and this and that and the other thing to decide. And they took a vote. Powers that be, and kept, I can't even remember what show, but kept one show on and took Trent off at that time.
Well, now I'm going to ask a very touchy question.
Yes.
I usually don't ask personal questions, but what happened in that stateroom? Do you know what I'm referring to?
No. Wait a minute.
I thought you would remember that.
Now, wait a minute.
For the benefit of our listeners,
yes,
this
is
what
happened.
Yes,
tell them and tell me again.
Helen was on a cruise ship, probably trying to forget Gil Whitney's marriage to Cynthia Swanson. Anyway, she met a handsome, rich gentleman, and he invited her for a drink after dinner and dancing. And she went in unchaperoned to his stateroom.
That's
and there the segment ended, and I understand that CBS was flooded with calls, wires, letters, postcards, all incensed that anyone would write such a sequence.
That's true, and I'm trying to remember how we weaseled out of it.
Well, I'm sure nothing happened.
No. Not with Helen Trent, I assure you. But I remember when that happened. That was terribly risque, and we got out of it some way. There was some great explanation, but we went into a long thing about it.
It was Time Magazine. I remember it distinctly. You see, I had faith in you. I never for a minute.
Well, that's a good
thing. Anything wrong with that at all. Now the other question. I was going to save this for the end, but I cannot stand it. I've wanted to know this for years. Is it possible for a woman 35 and even beyond to find romance?
Yes.
It is.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's a good thought, as Ann Elsner said. We want to hold that thought.
Hold that thought.
It is. Well, I guess it is, because you were about to get married, and God knows you were about to get married so many times.
So many times, that's right.
I read somewhere, and I can't remember what the age was, that you would have been, actually, the character, by the time you went off the air, in her 60s.
Well, yes, must be, certainly, because, 35 and even beyond, you could take
your
pick.
She had a swinging love life.
She did indeed.
Where did Helen live in California?
Oh.
She had a house. Gil lived in San Fernando Valley.
He lived in the valley, and she lived up in the hills somewhere or other. She had a Aren't that funny? I don't know if we ever even said. I don't think she was in the hills of Beverly. I think it was
a neighbor of mine. I always thought of Helen Trent as a Brentwood girl.
Well, let's say that. That's all right.
And you worked for, was it a Mr. Brody or Brophy, who was the movie producer at your studio?
Jeff Brady. And Lydia Brady, his wife, who left Helen Trent, and she became the star of a television show which has been going forever and ever. Oh, and I can't remember the name of it. Isn't that awful? But everybody's gone on to greater things. A lot of people have gone back to the theater.
Jenny was on my program, is going to be on my program soon.
Yes.
She said to say hello to you,
bless
Agnes
her heart.
Young.
Yes.
She'll be after you. And she told me that she has a running part of Mrs. Bento on one of the
many people. As a matter of fact, I'd love to be doing one if I lived in New York, but it's just too much of a production to try to do it from the country.
I always thought of radio characters when I listened to the radio of looking like movie stars that I'd seen, you know.
Yes.
Radio people weren't publicized.
That's
like
right.
Movie stars were. And I don't really remember how I thought of Helen Trent. I certainly didn't think she was as pretty as you, but I thought Agatha was Aline McMahon. I always thought that set face.
Isn't that not at all?
Black voice.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, that
no.
was how the character
but
came
that's,
across.
But that's probably the way she thought of herself. As a matter of fact, it was. I thought of myself, this might help you, as being very tall and stately, dignified, with black hair, in a bun thing, and terribly, terribly chic, terribly smart. Very sophisticated
yes.
looking.
Yes,
and, of course, very naive underneath.
Yes, Helen really was. She was getting involved in the damnedest things.
Oh, well, we had a deluge of letters one time because she got herself involved with a gangster. She really
did.
Do you remember that? He had the car and had a bar in it and telephones
yes.
and all sorts
of... Well, she was very broad-minded.
No, I think she was just foolish. But at least she always landed on her feet, which was fine.
I always thought something strange about radio. So many of you people went on in one part or in many parts, you know, for many years. But radio never really developed a star system, did it, as far as actors were concerned?
Well, it did in the early days. As a matter of fact, I came into it just as that was kind of at the peak and going down. Now, that was the Chicago. Yes, there were real radio stars in Chicago. Joan Blaine was one of them. She played... Oh, Valiant Lady. And she was a star with a following for her.
See, I don't remember that at all.
Well, this was, I think you probably were much too young, because as I say, I was, heavens, in my early, no, I guess, late-ish teens. And she was the last of the big radio stars of that sort of thing. But out in Chicago, they did develop them as stars. And Joan had her own secretary with, you know, the fan mail and the works. But when they moved here, salaries began going down, and that era was kind of over. And they, which I think was much wiser, we were much more identified just with the character as a character. And I think it was very wise because people could identify, as they cannot, for example, with television soaps, because they see what the person looks like. But in radio, they could really identify with us, and did. Oh, the letters I would get giving me advice and telling me not to, you know, beware of Cynthia Swanson and all these things. Very seriously.
Isn't that funny? Because
well, they
exactly
just got into these people's lives.
Of Ma Perkins and Arthur Hughes when he was just plain Bill.
Yes.
They were getting letters asking them for advice. What should they do?
Yes. Well, you see, everybody was trying to protect me because it was the completely different.
Do we see you on any television shows?
No. As I say, if I lived in New York, I'd love to be on something, but I couldn't possibly do it and live in the country. I went one day. I have a friend, Mary Kay Wells, who was on Trent for a while. She's a very close friend of mine. And she's on Edge of Night. And I went over one day to have lunch with her, and I just went through the day with them, not working. And I was a nervous wreck after it was over. I do not see how these people live. I mean, this has to be their whole life. doing television soaps. It's terribly grueling. Everybody. And it's, you know, it's tension from beginning to end.
That's funny, and radio was so relaxed.
Oh, yes. Fun. Well, you don't have that awful camera staring at you, you know, and that eye right on you, and you could read it, which was so great.
You must miss it, don't you?
Well, I do in one way. I managed to do two or three, maybe four television commercials. I just finished one for Campbell's Soup. And so I kind of keep my hand in a little bit that
way.
Well,
we can see you maybe on television.
Yes, I hope so. I certainly hope so. Chicken broth.
You taste it or stir it?
Oh, I'm stirring it and extolling its merits.
Those little dumplings that Campbell's Soup used to use, are they in the...
No.
I like those.
No.
Yes.
In fact, my first baby looked exactly like a Campbell Soup kid.
Well,
my Nancy.
Very cute.
She's darling. But anyway, the thing is that when Trent stopped, I had already stopped doing anything but that because I was playing golf and gardening. And also, the children began to be needing me. I mean, it was, you know, fine having a housekeeper when they were small. But long about then, I felt that maybe I'd better start being a mother. And I'm very glad because it's really paid off. Beautifully. My eldest daughter is going to Rosemary Hall, and she's a wonderful student. And she's playing Eliza Doolittle in their production of Pygmalion. It's her freshman year. And she got the thing, and she's in the Glee Club. And my little one played the littlest child in Sound of Music for the junior high school. They got her out of grade school. She's just in the fourth grade. So you see, we're busy. And I'm doing a one-act play for the North Castle Players, and doing a reading for the blind the end of March, and then another reading for the North Castle Players. So I haven't stopped.
Are they impressed that you were Helen?
Oh, very.
Really?
Yes, it's lovely.
The children of actors and actresses say, oh, no. Ruby Keeler said, oh, no, they think it's so ridiculous. But
no.
I sit up and watch my old movies on television. They just laugh at them. They say, oh, Mother, you're camp.
Isn't that cute? No, my two... They're very pleased about me, as a matter of fact. I mean, they don't, you know, go around mentioning it, but when it's mentioned, they're sort of happy.
If I played that theme again, would you get misty-eyed?
I don't think so.
Become overly emotional? Let's end on that theme, because that's very pretty. Juanita, I've been talking to Helen Trent, the lady who tried to prove and manage that romance can live in life at 35 and even beyond. Thank you, Miss Julie Stevens. Here are a few people who will be on Whatever Became Of in coming weeks. From the 1930s, the blonde beauty, Anita Louise, who made so many pictures back in those days. She is the widow of the Oscar-winning producer Buddy Adler. Christine Jorgensen, who needs no other explanation. Jack Pearl, probably better known as Baron Munchausen. From both movies and stage and radio, the surviving member of the famous team Wheeler and Woolsey, Bert Wheeler, will be here talking with me. And then another political program. I'll be talking to a consultant, to Mr. Harry Hopkins, who was the head of the Works Public Administration, that's better known as the WPA. Another political show, Mr. William L. Patterson, who is remembered as being called Mr. Civil Rights for so many years on his work on the Sacow and Vanzetti case, the Scottsboro Boys, and the Tom Mooney case. From the silent screen, Jacqueline Logan. And a big surprise when I announced about a year ago, the original, one and only, Baby Peggy is coming all the way from Mexico. Will be here and do a program with us. Please drop me a line if you're interested in any celebrity from the past. Write to Richard Lamparsky, WBAI, 30 East 39th Street, New York, New York. I hope you'll try us again next week at the same time when I'll be coming to you from the wilds of New Jersey, where my guest will be the co-author of the famous Taft-Hartley Act. His name is Congressman Fred A. Hartley, and he has a great deal to say about the late Senator Robert Taft and President Johnson's turnabout on labor legislation. This is Richard Lamparsky. Thanks for listening. And be with us again next week when we find out whatever became of Congressman Fred A. Hartley.